Chapter 66. Pitt stood frozen in time like some unspeakable apparition that had risen from the depths of a watery hell. He was saturated from head to foot, his black hair plastered down across a bloodied forehead, his lips curled in a satanic smile. In the light of the lamps, the droplets of water sparkled as they trickled from his wet clothing and splattered on the deck. Pavlov's face was a wax mask. Calmly, he pulled a cigarette from the gold case, lit it, and exhaled the smoke in a long sigh. "Your name? May I assume that your name is Dirk Pitt? That's what the fine print reads on the birth certificate." "It seems you are an uncommonly durable man, Mr. Pitt. It was my understanding that you were dead." "It just goes to prove you can't rely on shipboard gossip." Pitt took off his damp jacket and gently draped it over Dana's shoulders. "Sorry, dear heart, it's the best I can do for the moment." Then he turned back to Pavlov. "Any objections?" Pavlov shook his head. Pitt's offhand manner puzzled him. He scrutinized Pitt as a diamond cutter studies a stone, but saw nothing behind the veil of those sea-green eyes. Pavlov gestured to one of his men who moved up to Pitt. "Simply a precautionary search, Mr. Pitt. Any objections?" Pitt shrugged agreeably and held his hands in the air. The guard quickly, efficiently ran his hands up and down Pitt's clothing, and then stepped back and shook his head. "No arms," Pavlov said. "Very wise of you, but then I would have expected nothing less from a man of your reputation. I have read with considerable interest a dossier describing your exploits. I would have liked very much to have known you under less adversary circumstances." "Sorry, I can't return the compliment," Pitt said pleasantly. "But you're not exactly the type of vermin I'd like for a friend." Pavlov stepped forward 2 paces and hit Pitt with all his strength with the back of his hand. Pitt staggered back 1 step and stood there, a trickle of blood oozing from one corner of his still grinning lips. "Well, well," he said, quietly, thickly. "The illustrious Andrei Pavlov finally blew his cool." Pavlov leaned forward, his eyes half closed in wary speculation. "My name?" His voice was barely above a murmur. "You know my name?" "Fair is fair," Pitt answered. "I know as much about you as you know about me." "You're even cleverer than I was led to believe," Pavlov said. "You've discovered my identity, an astute piece of perception. On that I commend you. But you needn't bluff with knowledge you do not possess. Beyond my name, you know nothing." "I wonder. Perhaps I can enlighten you further with a bit of local folklore." "I have no patience for fairy tales," Pavlov said. He motioned to the guard with the knife. "Now, if we can get on about the business of persuading Admiral Sandecker to inspire your pumping crew to greater efforts, I would be most grateful." The guard, a tall man, his face still hidden under the muffler, began advancing toward Dana once more. He extended the knife. Its blade gleamed in the light, no more than 3 inches from Dana's left breast. She hugged Pitt's jacket tightly around her shoulders and stared at the knife, numbed beyond fear. "Too bad you're not big on fairy tales," Pitt said conversationally. "This is one you'd have enjoyed. It's all about a pair of bumbling characters called Silver and Gold." Pavlov glanced at him, hesitated, and then nodded the guard back. "You have my attention, Mr. Pitt. I will give you 5 minutes to prove your point." "It won't take long," Pitt said. He paused to rub the eye that had caked closed from the hardening blood. "Now then, once upon a time, there were 2 Canadian engineers who discovered that spying could be a lucrative sideline. So they shed all qualms of guilt and became professional espionage agents in every sense of the word, concentrating their talents on obtaining classified data about American oceanographic programs and sending it through hidden channels to Moscow. Silver and Gold earned their money, make no mistake. Over the past 2 years, there wasn't a NUMA project the Russians didn't have knowledge of down to the tiniest detail. Then, when the Titanic salvage came up, the Soviet Navy's Department of Foreign Intelligence, your department, Pavlov, smelled a windfall. Without the slightest degree of chicanery, you found yourself with not one but two men in your employ who were in a perfect situation to obtain and pass along America's most advanced deepwater salvage techniques. There was, of course, another vital consideration, but even you weren't aware of it at the time. Silver and Gold, Pitt went on, sent regular reports concerning the raising of the wreck through an ingenious method. They used a battery-powered pinger, a device that can transmit underwater sound waves similar to sonar. I should have caught on to it when the Capricorn sonar man detected the transmissions, but instead I dismissed it as loose debris caused by a deep-water current knocking about the Titanic. The fact that someone was sending out coded messages never entered our heads. Nobody bothered to decipher the random noises. Nobody, that is, except the man sitting under a set of hydrophones on board the Mikhail Kurkov. Pitt paused and glanced about the dining saloon. He had everyone's attention. We didn't begin to smell either rat until Henry Monk felt the need for a poorly timed call of nature. On his way back to the head at the aft end of the Sappho II, he heard the pinging device in operation and investigated. He caught one of the agents in the act. Your man probably tried to lie his way out of it, but Henry Monk was an instrument specialist. He recognized a communications pinger when he saw one and quickly figured the game. It was a case of the cat killing curiosity. Monk had to be silenced, and he was, from a blow to the base of the skull by one of Woodson's camera tripods. This created an awkward situation for the murderer, so he bashed Monk's head against the alternator housing to make it look like an accident. However, the fish didn't take the bait. Woodson was suspicious. I was suspicious. And to top it off, Doc Bailey found the bruise on Monk's neck. But since there was no way of proving who the killer was, I decided to string along with the accident story until I could scratch up enough evidence to point an accusing finger. Later, I went back and searched the submersible and discovered one slightly used and very bent camera tripod, along with the pinging device where our friendly neighborhood spy had, ironically, hidden them in Monk's own storage locker. Certain that it was a waste of time to have them checked on shore for fingerprints, I didn't need a bolt from the blue to tell me I was dealing with a professional. I left the tripod and the pinger exactly as I found them. I took the chance that it would only be a matter of time before your agent got complacent and began contacting the Mikhail Kurkov again. So I waited. A fascinating story, Prevlov said, but very circumstantial. Absolute proof would have been impossible to come by. Pitt smiled enigmatically and continued. The proof came through a process of elimination. I was relatively sure the killer had to be one of the three men on board the submersible who were supposedly asleep during their rest period. I then alternated the Sappho II's crew schedule every few days, so that two of them had duties on the surface, while the third was diving below on the wreck. When our sonar man picked up the next transmission from the pinger, I had Monk's murderer. "Who is it, Pitt?" Spencer asked grimly. "There are 10 of us here. Was it one of us?" Pitt locked eyes for an instant with Prevlov, and then turned suddenly and nodded at one of the weary men huddled under the lamps. "I regret that the only introductory fanfare I can offer is the pounding of the waves against the hull. But bear with me and take a bow anyway, drummer. It may well be your final encore before you toast in the electric chair." "Ben Drummer?" Gunn gasped. "I can't believe it. Not with him sitting there all battered and bloody after attacking Woodson's killer." "Local color," Pitt said. It was too early to raise the curtain on his identity, not at least until we had all walked the plank. Until then, Prevlov needed an informer to blow the whistle on any ideas we might have dreamed up for retaking the ship. "He fooled me," said Giordino. "He's worked harder than any two men on the crew to keep the Titanic floating." "Has he?" Pitt came back. "Sure, he's looked busy, even managed to work up a sweat and get dirty. But what have you actually seen him accomplish since we came on board?" Gunn shook his head. "But he's... Rather, I thought that he'd been working day and night surveying the ship." "Surveying the ship? Hell! Drummer has been running around with a portable acetylene torch and cutting holes in her bottom." "I can't buy that," said Spencer. Why work at scuttling a ship if his Russian chums want to lay their claws on her, too? A desperate gamble to delay the tow, Pitt answered. Timing was critical. The only chance the Russians had to board the Titanic with any degree of success was during the eye of the hurricane. It was clever thinking. The possibility never occurred to us. If the tugs could have towed the hulk without any complications, we'd have missed the eye by 30 miles. But thanks to Drummer, the instability of the listing hull made the tow job a shambles. Before the cable parted, she sheared all over the ocean, forcing the tugs to reduce their speed to minimum steerage way. And, as you can see, the mere presence of Pribilov and his band of cutthroats attest to the success of Drummer's efforts. The truth began to register then. None of the salvage crew had actually witnessed Drummer slaving over a pump or offering to carry his share of the load. It registered that he'd always been off on his own, showing up only to complain of his frustration at not overcoming the obstacles that supposedly prevented his survey tour of the ship. They stared at Drummer as though he was some alien from another world, waiting for, expecting the indignant words of denial. There was to be no denial, no shocked plea of innocence, only a flicker of annoyance that vanished as quickly as it had come. Drummer's transformation was nothing short of astounding. The sad droop to the eyes had disappeared. They suddenly took on a glinting sharpness. Gone, too, was the lazy curl from the corners of his lips and the slouched, indifferent posture of his body. The indolent facade was gone, and in its place was a straight-shouldered, almost aristocratic-looking man.
"Permit me to say, Pitt," Drummer said in a precise tone, "your powers of observation would do a first-class espionage agent proud. However, you haven't uncovered anything that really changes the situation."
"Fancy that," Pitt said. "Our former colleague has suddenly lost his jubilation tea cornpone accent."
"I mastered it rather skillfully, don't you think?"
"That's not all you mastered, Drummer. Somewhere in your budding career, you learned how to win secrets and murder friends."
"A necessity of the trade," Drummer said.
He had eased away from the salvage crew until he was standing beside Pribilov.
"Tell me, which one are you, silver or gold?"
"Not that it matters any longer," Drummer shrugged. "I'm gold."
"Then your brother is silver."
Drummer's smug expression hardened. "You know this?" he said slowly. "After I had you pegged, I turned over my evidence, meager as it was, to the FBI. I have to hand it to Pribilov and his comrades at Soviet Naval Intelligence. They laid a phony history on you that was as American as apple pie, or should I say Georgia peach pie, and seemingly as genuine as the Confederate flag. But the Bureau finally broke through the false documents, certifying your impeccable security clearance, and tracked you all the way back to the old homestead in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where you and your brother were born. Within 10 minutes of each other, I might add."
"My God," Spencer muttered. "Twins."
"Yes, but non-identical. They don't even look like brothers."
"So it became a simple case of one twin leading to the other," Spencer said.
"Hardly simple," Pitt replied. "They're a smart pair, Drummer and his brother. You can't take that away from them. That was my prime mistake, attempting to draw a parallel between two men who should have had the same likes and dislikes, who shared the same quarters, or who palled around together. But silver and gold played opposite roles to the core. Drummer was equally chummy to everyone and lived alone. I was at a dead end. The FBI was trying to trace Drummer's brother while rechecking the security clearances of every member of the salvage crew, but nobody could make a definite connection. Then a break in the form of near tragedy burst on the scene and pinned the tail on the donkey.
"The Deep Fathom accident," Gunn said, staring at Drummer through cold, unblinking eyes.
"But Drummer had no relation on the submersible. He was on the crew of this AFO, too."
"He had a very real relation. You see, his brother was on the Deep Fathom."
"How did you guess that?" Drummer asked.
"Twins have a curious bond. They think and feel things as one. You may have masqueraded as two totally unrelated persons, Drummer, but the two of you were too close for one of you not to become unglued when the other was on the brink of death. You felt your brother's agony just as surely as if you were trapped down there in the abyss with him.
Of course, Gunn said. We were all on edge at the time, but Drummer was damn near hysterical.
Again, it became a process of elimination among three men. This time, Chavez, Keel, and Merker. Chavez is obviously of Mexican descent, and you can't fake that. Keel is 8 years too young. You can't fake that either. That left Sam Merker.
Damn, Spencer muttered. How could we have been taken in for so long?
Not hard to imagine, when you consider that we were up against the best team the Russians could field. A smile tugged at Pitt's lips. Incidentally, Spencer, you previously stated that there were 10 of us here. You miscounted. There are 11. You neglected to include Jack the Ripper there. He turned to the guard, who was still standing in front of Dana, still clutching the knife in his hand as if it had grown there. Why don't you drop your stupid disguise, Merker, and join the party? The guard slowly removed his cap and unwound the muffler that covered the lower half of his face.
He's the dirty bastard that knifed Woodson, Giardino hissed.
Sorry about that, Merker said calmly. Woodson's first mistake was in recognizing me. He might have lived if he had let it go at that. His second mistake, and a very fatal one, was attacking me.
Woodson was your friend.
The business of espionage makes no allowances for friends.
Merker, Sandecker said. Merker and Drummer. Silver and gold. I trusted you both, and yet you sold Numa down the river. For 2 years you sold us. And for what? A few lousy dollars.
I wouldn't say a few, Admiral. Merker eased the knife back into its sheath. More than enough to support my brother and me in fashionable style for a long time to come.
Hey, where did he come from? Gunn asked. Merker is supposed to be in Doc Bailey's sick bay on board the Capricorn.
He stowed away on Sturgis's helicopter, Pitt said, patting his bleeding head with a damp handkerchief.
Can't be, Sturgis blurted out. You were there, Pitt, when I opened the cargo hatch. Except for Mrs. Seagram, the copter was empty.
Merker was there, all right. After he gave Doc Bailey the slip, he kept away from his own cabin and made for Brother Drummer's quarters, where he borrowed a fresh change of clothing, including a pair of cowboy boots. Then he sneaked onto the helicopter, threw out the emergency life raft, and hid under its cover. Unfortunately for Dana, she happened along in search of her makeup kit. When she knelt down to retrieve it, her eye caught Merker's boots protruding from under the life raft cover. Not about to let her screw up his escape, he popped her on the head with a hammer he'd found lying around somewhere, wrapped her in a tarpaulin, and crawled back into his hiding space.
That means he was still in the cargo compartment when we uncovered Mrs. Seagram.
No, by then he was gone. If you recall, after you switched open the cargo door, we waited for a few moments, listening for any movement inside. There was none because Merker had already crept into the control cabin, under the cover of the noise from the door actuator motors. Then, when you and I played Keystone Cops and entered the cargo compartment, he dropped down the cockpit ladder outside and walked peacefully into the night.
But why throw the hammer into the rotor blades? Sturgis persisted. What was the purpose?
Since you flew the copter from the Capricorn empty, Merker said, and there was no freight to unload, I couldn't risk the chance of your taking off again without opening the cargo door. You had me trapped back there and didn't know it.
You became a busy little beaver after that, Pitt said to Merker, flitting about the ship, guided, no doubt, by a diagram provided by Drummer.
First, you took your brother's portable cutting rig and burned off the tow cable, while Chief Bascom and his men were resting in the gymnasium between inspection tours. Next, you cut the mooring lines to the helicopter, taking great satisfaction, I'm certain, in knowing that it was swept over the side of the ship with me in it.
Two birds with one slice, Merker admitted. Why deny?
Merker was cut short by a muffled burst from a submachine gun that echoed from somewhere on the decks below. Prevlov shrugged and looked at Sandecker.
I fear your men below are proving difficult.
He removed the cigarette from its holder and crushed it out with his boot.
I think this discussion has lasted long enough. The storm will be abating in a few hours, and the Mikhail Kurkov will move into position for the tow.
Admiral Sandecker, You will see to it your men cooperate in manning the pumps. Drummer will show you the locations where he's pierced the hull below the waterline so that the rest of your crew can stem the leakage.
So it's back to the torture games,
Sandecker said contemptuously. I am through playing games, Admiral. Pavlov had a determined look. He spoke to one of the guards, a short man with a coarsened toughness about him, the same guard who had shoved his gun into Sandecker's side. This is Buski, a very direct fellow who happens to be the finest marksman in his regiment. He also understands a smattering of English, enough at any rate to translate numerical progression. He turned to the guard. Buski, I am going to begin counting. When I reach 5, you will shoot Mrs. Seagram in the right arm. At 10, in the left. At 15, in the right knee. And so on, until Admiral Sandecker mends his uncooperative ways. A businesslike concept, Pitt added. And you'll shoot the rest of us after we've served your purpose, weight our bodies and dump them in the sea so they're never found. Then you'll claim we abandoned the ship in the helicopter, which, of course, conveniently crashed. You'd even provide 2 witnesses, Drummer and Merker, who would testify after their miraculous survival about how the benevolent Russians plucked them from the sea just as they were going down for the 3rd time. I see no need to prolong the agony any further, Pavlov said tiredly. Buski? Buski raised his machine pistol and took aim at Dana's arm. You intrigue me, Pavlov, Pitt said. You've shown little interest in how I learned Drummer and Merker's code names, or why I didn't have them thrown in the brig after I ferreted out their identities. You don't even seem curious as to how I came to know your name. Curious, yes, but it makes no difference. Nothing can change the circumstances. Nothing and no one can help you and your friends, Pitt. Not now. Not the CIA or the whole United States Navy. The die is cast. There will be no more play with words. Pavlov nodded at Buski. 1. When Captain Pavlov reaches the count of 4, you will die, Buski. Buski leered smugly and made no reply. 2. We knew your plans for taking the Titanic. Admiral Sandecker and I have known for the last 48 hours. You've run your last bluff, Pavlov said. 3. Pitt shrugged indifferently. Then all blood is on your hands, Pavlov. 4. An ear-shattering blam rang deafeningly through the dining saloon as the bullet caught Buski just below the hairline and between the eyes, catapulting a quarter of his skull in a crimson blur of slow motion, snapping his head upward and slamming him to the deck in an inert spread eagle at Pavlov's feet. Dana cried out in startled pain as she was slammed to the deck. There were no apologies from Pitt for throwing her there and then crushing the breath out of her as he used his 190 pounds for a protective shield. Giordino dove for Sandecker and hauled him down with all the intensity of a desperation tackle by a linebacker for the Green Bay Packers. The rest of the salvage crew wasted no more than a tenth of a second in demonstrating their fondness for self-preservation. They scattered and dropped like leaves in a windstorm, closely followed by Drummer and Merker, who fell as though shackled together. The blast was still ringing in the far corners of the room when the guards came alive and began firing bursts from their submachine pistols into the darkness toward the dining saloon entrance. It was a meaningless gesture. The first was cut down almost instantly, pitching forward on his face. The second flung his machine pistol into the air and clutched the river of red that burst from his neck, while the third sank slowly to his knees, staring dumbly at the 2 small holes that had suddenly appeared in the center of his coat. Now Pavlov stood alone. He stared down at them all, and then at Pitt. His expression was one of acceptance of defeat and death. He nodded a salute at Pitt, and then calmly pulled his automatic from the holster and began firing into the darkness. He expended his clip and stood there, waiting for the gun flash, braced for the pain that must surely come. but there was no return fire. The room went silent. Everything seemed to slow down, and only then did the revelation burst on him. He was not meant to die. It had been a trap, and he had walked into it as naively as a small child into a tiger's den. A name began to tear at his very soul, taunting him, repeating itself over and over again. Marganyan. Marganyan. Marganyan.